Hello, welcome to episode 5 of Hong Kong Gore. I'm very happy about this episode, but I'm already starting. My name is Wing Ho Lin, and I'm
My name is Matthew.
Yep. And yes, I'm very excited about this episode because last episode, I also gave you the choice of picking a film, and I think you felt it's time, given the face
of our podcast. Yes. Oh,
exactly. It's Chow Yun Fat. It's like, we have to do a Chow Yun Fat film. And we've kind of like gone back and forth of which one should we do, the obvious one, or should we just like pick something kind of random?
But yes, then... there could have been bullets in the heads. But really, I think The Killer is so good. It's just so good. And I rewatched it, and it's even better than I remember.
I was like,
"It's so good."
See, here's the thing. We will get into like, I guess, flaws of the actual film. But to be honest with you, I'm gonna be like extremely biased because I will say this: if I have like, let's say, a top 100 favorite Hong Kong film like ever, this will be my number one, no question.
It's up there. No, I'm not sure what my number one is, but it's definitely up there. Rewatching it, I'm like, yeah, that's all time classic.
I mean, if it's not in your top 10, we're gonna have conversation.
No, it's not top 10. It's a top 10. We won't get to that discussion because it's definitely a top 10. I just haven't thought of it.
I have four of it because I have no life. So,
well, speaking about lives.
Yes.
You had a lot on your plate.
Yeah. Oh, God. And it is like... Okay, so this is... The first story is actually Hong Kong cinema related, so I'll get to that. But for the longest time, I couldn't like speak about it because, you know... I wasn't under like an... What's the term?
NDA.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. And I wasn't like an NDA.
Non-disclosure agreement.
Yeah, but I was like, you know, you can't like put this out there. You know, just keep it a secret until it's released. It's released now. It's out there. I'm happy.
The official.
So basically, back in February, I was actually... I was asked by an old friend who I used to work with, Hugh David. I'm going to just name... I'm sure he won't mind.
Hello to him.
I hope he's all well. He basically reached out to me and asked me... Because I think he kind of clocked on that... I don't know. Maybe he has clocked on that I have done a couple of acting things, you know, this past few years. And he was like saying, listen, are you interested in like an acting job for something? I was like, all right, yeah. And he kind of introduced me to a gentleman, a very nice and fantastic gentleman by the name of James Piercy.
Hello to him too.
Yep. I really hope I'm actually kind of like, oh shit, did I actually say his name right? Because but it's like, I'm terrible with names. Like even like the most basic ones, kind of thing. It's like, John Smith, is that how you pronounce it? I'm that guy. Okay. But anyway, James, we basically had a bit of a back and forth. And he was like, well, so here's the thing. We kind of reached out to you because we're looking for a performer. Or an actor who could feasibly be part of, because we're kind of like creating a documentary and we kind of want to recreate some scenes of a film. And essentially the film in question is actually Game of Death. And the actor is essentially Bruce Lee.
That was incredible teasing from you. Like the amount of time you just took to end up on this and say, like, yeah, I'm playing Bruce Lee in DVDs. Like, guess what? I'm the greatest. Yes, he is the greatest.
He is the greatest. And to be honest with you, I was a bit reluctant because I was kind of like, I don't know about that, kind of thing. Because it's like, it's Bruce Lee. No one can really, like, like the, you know the there was a period after Bruce Lee's death, there was like a period where you got like a
exploitation, right?
Exactly. And essentially I'm like, oh, I'm gonna become part of that problem, aren't I? I'm gonna be part of that.
That's a legacy.
I mean, that is a legacy. You know, funny you should say that, because there is actually a documentary that actually goes through the legacy of all the actors who essentially kind of like rode on the Bruce exploitation wagon, actually. So yeah, that's, so yeah, don't get me wrong, that's a, that is a legacy that is, you know, questionable, but you know, is also like legit in the sense that
you're now part of the same legacy than Yuen Bao that we talked about in Eastern Condors.
Oh my god,
that's take that in, like,
oh yeah,
it's that cool.
I mean, it's pretty cool. Although I will say this, it's more of a self-aware sort of Bruceploitation type of thing that they're approaching. So it wasn't like we were aiming to actually like, oh, we're going to like do a Bruce Lee thing. It's like,
you know, Bruce Lee.
Yeah, exactly. It was very much, and I didn't have to like, you know, do any moves. It was more a case of like, oh, I'm just, you know, I'm just there to sort of act. I give a pretty bad impression of Bruce. I'm sure it's great.
Don't listen to this guy. I mean, listen to the podcast, but don't listen to what he says about himself, because it's. I'm sure it's great. I haven't even seen it. I know it's great.
But yeah, I was there to sort of like Bruce it up, you know, kind of thing. And it was, you know, it was very cool. The director, James Flower, it was basically his vision, you know, because his approach to this documentary is that he takes all the sort of Game of Death rushes, put it together in this sort of like long, almost 4-hour sort of documentary, uncut. Like, because previously I don't know if a lot of people, I'm sure fans of Hong Kong cinema will actually know about the history of Game of Death, but for people who are not familiar, basically Bruce Lee was in the middle of making Game of Death, but he never finished it because he unfortunately obviously passed away, you know, at a very young age of like 32, I believe. So that
and
film was
during the shooting of Game of Death.
During the shooting, yeah, exactly. So he only shot the final pretty much most of the final sort of climactic battles, like the three fight scenes, and you know, I guess Golden Harvest didn't, I think it was Golden Harvest, and they didn't know what to do with it. Yeah, and what they did was they re-edited the footage, and basically, and for like, so it, you only get like 10 minutes of Bruce Lee fight, and then shot like a bunch of new stuff with a standing actor to actually play Bruce Lee, and they were incorporating footage from the previous films, from Fist of Fury and Way of the Dragon. It was just it was a weird Frankenstein type.
It's a mess, really.
Yeah, I know that Bruce Lee in the yellow tracksuit is like probably arguably his most iconic image, in my opinion. But the fact that it's in a film that is kind, I don't know, in my opinion, it's kind of shit. I can't really like watch it with like, you know, with a straight face, you know, I feel like I have to watch it with a beer or something like that, because you know, it's not great.
We'll come back to this, but what people remember versus what actually is in the movie is a thing that we're going to talk about with the killer for sure.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, but there was some things about that film that it's just ropey, but and also downright offensive. But anyway, the point of the documentary is that they're gonna present all the rushes, and there's gonna be like a sort of a narration over it. So it's kind of like, commenting on like Bruce's shooting style, and you know, the shoot and his directing style and fight choreography, or his approach to fight choreography. Sorry, I'm a bit all over the place. But he wanted to bookmark it with a scene, like, you know, sort of like, because there were actual notes that, and plans to shoot a scene where Bruce Lee's character Hai Tian is, you know, in the villain's lair looking at slides of, you know, of the mission that he has to like sort of like take, yeah, accomplish and take on. And that's the, you know, that's, you know, that, and that's the scene. They never shot that scene, but they apparently they were going to shoot it. And for me, and they were like, okay, so let's create that one segment, but with with an Asian accent.
Standing,
yeah, exactly. So it's a self-aware, it's a more of a self-aware sort of, I guess, Bruceploitation type thing, you know. So yeah, they brought me on. And it was really cool, actually. It was a really cool experience, and they were really lovely. And, you know, and clearly they wanted to make something, you know, very, you know, a meaningful sort of documentary. Because Game of Death is one of those films that you want it to be a great film, you want that part of the legacy to be, to actually mean something. And I think, especially to like a bunch of fans, and I feel like James Flower really, you know, wanted to like sort of legitimize Game of Death. Not that it was never legitimized, but, you know, I think, you know, if you look at the film, it's like,
make it less of a botched mess,
really. Yeah. And, you know, people have actually, the thing is, yeah, he wasn't like the first one who actually attempted it. You know, I think previously they tried to re-edit all the rushes and make it like a sort of like I suppose a kind of a short film of like what Bruce would have done if he actually were to finish it. But, you know, but I find that kind of questionable, you know, kind of thing.
Well, yeah, because it's obvious. I mean, the guy's dead, so like,
yeah, exactly. Really say that. You know, and you know, and you're
you
trying
just
to
do your best.
Yeah, yeah. You can't really, you know, you can't really imitate his voice. You know, you can't really just go in and just say, "I'm going to like approach this film as if I'm Bruce Lee." I find that kind of iffy, to be honest with you. So
to say the least, yes.
Yeah, and I think James Flower did, I think, a much more smarter and, in my opinion, a more respectful approach, is that I'm going to, like, sort of take all the rushes and sort of, like, basically analyze in context with, in context as, not as a, trying to be a creator, trying to be Bruce Lee the creator, but rather analyze and sort of break down Bruce Lee's creative process from like a filmmaker's point of view, kind of thing. And
which that, is really cool.
Yeah, I think that's a very sort of ingenious approach. So, you know, good on James for actually sort of taking that approach. And
so
yeah.
Where is this going to be available?
So this will be available on the Bruce Lee box set 4K. But if you just want to check out the documentary, it is actually available on the Arrow Video website. So go on Arrow Video website and you can actually just, you know, I think they charge like a small fee. You can actually watch online and you can, and you know, and you can actually, and
I think
you
it's
know.
Also linked to Amazon, Apple.
Oh, is it really? Yeah,
I think, yeah, the yeah. Arrow Video, yeah,
yeah. So the acting job actually led to a writing job as well. So yeah, exactly. So it's like it's the job that it's the gift that keeps giving. They would like, so the documentary, the narration, a good portion of the narration was already written by James Flower himself and also another gentleman, Brandon Bentley. But there were two sections that they wanted to sort of like, I guess they wanted to delve deeper into Bruce's fight choreography and directing, and they basically asked me, so do you want to like sort of like give it a stab, because we know that you know this is kind of, you also know, but you seem to know about a lot about Hong Kong cinema, and you know, and also I wrote my dissertation on physical performance in the genre as well. So
you also have a very good blog that many people seem to read, but is really good and has some really good articles on it. So it's linked in the description of the
nice.
On the podcast. So definitely check it out.
Cool, nice. I like smooth. Thank you, Matt.
It's called Synergy.
Yes, Synergy. Thank you, Matthew. I feel like you're my
small coordination, but yeah. Yes, exactly. That's I'm the flavor player of the bunch. But there you go. Anyway, but, yes, yeah. you so doing some writing.
So yeah, I did. So yeah, so yeah, Exactly. So I did some writing and I contributed to it, and you know, James seemed to really like it. So I've actually, I've got the book that I've managed to get the box set, but I've yet to actually watch the documentary actually, because I've just been incredibly busy, which I will get into. But yeah, that's kind of like my big thing. You know, this is definitely Hong Kong cinema related, and I've been involved in a Hong Kong cinema project, you know, and you know, celebrating Bruce, yeah, 50th anniversary of Bruce Lee, you know. So it's a, you know, it's like
I gotta say
the writing, you know, because I'm also writing a novel that is very much inspired by Hong Kong cinema, so I feel like, you know, there's one of those moments where I feel quite legit, you know, just a little bit more legit,
just a bit,
you know,
just a bit,
yeah, exactly. But it's also, it's funny because I was a bit kind of it's funny, it's like a whole domino effect. So because of this job, I actually found out about a theater company, because I wanted to sort of like try out acting, or at least pursue it in some capacity. And so I was working alongside with that project. He introduced me to this sort of theater society called New Earth Theater, and what it is it's a theater society that is a space for BECE actors and creatives, and you know, basically BECE essentially stands for British East and Southeast Asians. So it's you know, it's basically a space for, you know, creators who are from that ethnic from those specific ethnic backgrounds, because you know, it's like it's about creating spaces and creating visibility for us, where, because it's, you know, as far as we like, as much as we like to think that, you know, the industry is actually changing and moving forward, you know, there are still improvements to be made. And
oh yeah, I think that's the point, is that it's moving forward, yeah, but it started from so far back that it needs to catch up with
It really does. And you know, and I think New Earth Theatre was created by BECEA actors who were tired of, you know, just not finding opportunities, and what opportunities there were like questionable, because it's kind of like, well, the roles have been, there are essentially nothing roles, or roles that just are just downright offensive. So I was under the New Earth Academy Plus program, which is a 2-week long program. It's an intensive, and we just basically work on voice, acting, movement, and you know, and it kind of correlates into like a group of us putting together a showcase that talks about that basically delves deep into a subject that has to do with our ethnic background, and for this case it's about migration and sort of like what that means to each of us, because it was basically a group of like 16, and despite some of those experiences, there are definitely like nuances and textures in our stories that really highlights that, you know, we are together, but we also have different voices. It's not just one story that you expect. Do you know what I mean? It's like, because there seems to be just one narrative when it comes to like, oh, you're talking about East Asian migrants. It's like, no, there's different narratives, you know, depending. But yeah, I explained that, you know, properly, because I feel like New Earth Theatre is a space that every BECEA artist and creative should know about, because
this definitely sounds,
yeah,
great.
I mean,
and you seem to have like a really good
I mean, it was led by Broderick Chow, who's essentially the course leader, and you know, he was like this amazing leader who essentially just spearheaded and just really coordinated all of our creative strengths into something that is, into this big sort of showcase at the end. And it's like, oh wow, you know, and you know, he watched over us, you know, he really felt like, you know, I was like, you know, were being looked after. And they also brought in Joanne Lau, who's like a really great writer and who recently did a play called Worth, which is like a production that was just finished. And, you know, and she came from that and into this. And what she, and the writing ability of this woman is like amazing. She just in the span of like a week, she just she crafted like 9 scripts just out of like just us, you know, sort of like telling our stories and like and us sort of demonstrating our strengths as performers and, you know, sort of like and writing these scripts for us to sort of like, okay, these are going to be, I suppose, your platforms in order to express your stories. You know, I was like, oh, this is actually really, this is really cool. And, you know, and they were legit really good. I think, you know, it's nice that, you know, you have a writer sort of like, oh yeah, it's, you know, it's sort of like, I'm giving you like an opportunity to sort of like perform. But, you know, I'm looking at it from a writer's perspective. I'm looking at these scripts. It's like, these are really good scripts regardless. Do you know what I mean? I think you could easily put this out there and people would still be like, oh, this is actually just, yeah, it's great. This is actually really great stuff, you know? And because she really does like tell stories with, she really does has this really amazing ability of just taking serious subjects and giving a lot more different textures in terms of like tone and emotions, because I think the idea of migration is for the most part is actually like, it's a serious issue. And to be honest with you, it has become more of a fucking serious issue because the amount of fucking hurdles that people have to go through just to like get the right to actually stay at a certain country, you know, is kind of ridiculous. But there are also but Joanne manages to sort of take that subject and to sort of bring different textures in terms of like, you know, that you can easily see the funny side of the things or even the more heartfelt, you know, and also more heartfelt and more serious sides. But there's also like the funny sides and even the ridiculous sides, you know, of like migration. So, yeah. But yeah, I highly, you know, if there are any BECEA artists and performers, actors, out there who haven't really gone through the New Earth Theatre Academy, I highly recommend doing it because it's great. I mean, like the class that I was in, the group I was in, I was like everyone was like super talented. Like everyone had like their skills are like up there. I mean, I felt a bit like, oh shit, I have to like step up. Do you know what I mean? Like I was like, oh fuck. How do I get here? All right, I feel like really.
And Danny Beacon.
Well, you know, I don't. But you know, for me, it was like I had to like really step up, really like show that. Yeah, I can act. I can do stuff. I can play a part in this group. So, but yeah.
Yes, we call as somebody who works in libraries, we call that imposter syndrome. Don't worry, it never goes away, and you just live with
it
for. You'll be alright.
Yeah, it was fine. I mean, we literally just had our showcase yesterday. In fact, when you texted me, I was like, we do the podcast today. I was like, yeah, let's do it. I think I have some energy for it because it was like, here's the thing. It was super intensive. Like it wasn't just intensive training. We were also just, you know, devising and writing, you know, even contributing to some writing of our own monologues, you know, and it's like, and you know, just practice. And it was like this whole showcase was, you know, just put together in the span of like a week and a half, essentially, which is like crazy, you know, if you think about it. But that's a massive turnaround. And the fact that we managed to like pull it off, I'm just proud that I'm just like part of the group, really, and managed to sort of like pull out something that quickly and managed to like and do it, you know. I mean, I speak for myself, do it well enough, but everyone really like knocked it out of the park. So yeah, I'm gonna miss
it. It's a shame we won't be able to see that. On the other hand, but do check out the Bruce Lee box set.
Yeah.
So coming from our video, is already available.
Yeah, it's right. They literally came out. What? I think the release date was like 19th July. Yeah.
So it's gonna be out when we release it.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. So being very busy. All of them are good busy, not like this is, oh, is this fucking life busy? No, this is very good busy. So
yes.
Yeah. But yeah, that was like my,
that was your,
that was my thing so far in 2023. So yeah,
not bad. So shall we move on to the subject?
Yes.
Which is The Killer. So to talk about The Killer, I wanted to just raise kind of a general question, because we both watched this movie, I think, you said yourself, way too young. And I think it was released in 1989.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure I watched it like a few years after it was released.
Yeah.
So I was born in 1982. I'm pretty sure I watched it when I was 11 or 12.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
What does the character of Cho Yun-fat in The Killer, but maybe in general, means to you?
Yeah,
because to me, it's definitely a guy that embodies a certain kind of masculinity that I kind of aspire to, not just in the sense of being cool,
yeah,
but like how just he is as a person.
Yeah, his moral compass, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. For me, it's okay. So I've mentioned this like prior to the recording. I've seen this film way too young, like way too young. Basically, what happened is that I think the first time I saw this film was like, I think I was 9 or 10, and I was very much like a kid who likes to like, you know, when you're a kid, you like to like treasure hunt sometimes. You know, it's the curiosity in you. You just want to like hunt down for like stuff that interests you. And basically, I went through, I mean, I don't recommend any, I mean, every kid's going to do it anyway, but you know, but as
I don't think there's 12 year olds listening to us. So I think
we're, yeah, but there I was, as a kid, I like going through like the drawers in our house, because it's like, oh, you know, because, you know, it was very, I don't know, in my head, it's like, oh, am I going to find Narnia or something like that? You know, I just want to find something that is, because, you know, sometimes kids get bored. And I found like a drawer full of like VHSs. Now, for people who are like too young, VHS is essentially a videotape, and that's where films used, or not anything, films, TV used to be on. I don't know how to describe it. They used to be, it's like a rectangular black plastic thing that has like film inside it, but it's not really film, but you know, yeah, it's one of those contraptions. But anyway, so there were some VHSs that actually has some Hong Kong films, and it pretty much introduced me to Hong Kong cinema. And one of those tapes was a really crappy copy of The Killer. Like, when I mean crappy, I mean like this is clearly bootleg type deal. You know, so, and it's like in my head is like, how did mom get her hands into this? But you know, whatever. But I watched it.
Well, we brought your mom in right now. I haven't.
But yeah, I watched it pretty much in secret, because my mom was very much like, she doesn't like, you know, showing me like violent Hong Kong films, especially ones that involve triads. But you know, I managed to sneak in this viewing, and I absolutely loved it. And the thing is that I liked it because, you know, it's like, oh, this is like, because it's new, it's cool, and it's like, it's like Chang Yun-fat, you know, world in two guns. But I honestly know I was too young and too stupid, but it's also, it was the first film that ever made me cry, like feel like overwhelming emotion.
That's a thing we're going to talk about just after maybe a bit more. It's really what people think about when we think of The Killer, which is what you said, the two guns and people shooting at each other and like holding guns at each other.
Yeah. And I think,
but it's a tragic,
it's a tragic movie. But I think, you know, because at that point, you know, I've just watched like Power Ranger episodes where it's always like, oh, the hero saves the day. But here it's like,
well, let's not get into too much details.
Yeah, exactly. I won't get into I won't get into too much details, but you know, I feel like the film, what exemplifies is that the idea of one trying to uphold a certain moral compass, and knowing the fact that that is a a futile sort of like knowing that it's a losing battle and yet still trying your best to pursue it regardless. And that for me, that's what sort of, that's what the Chang'e Fat character Ajong really means to me. You know, it's the fact that
his values mean more to him than his life.
Or at least
he's willing to risk everything for
Values. It's about following a certain moral code, and sometimes you have to follow that code and go against, you know, the codes of what circumstances you're in, because he's essentially a killer for a hired gun for the triads. That's what So
he's a killer for hire in the mold of what how killers used to be represented, or at least the underworld was represented, because it had a code. And we talked about that in our previous episode, when we talked about the mission, how the underworld in those movies is represented as, oh, those people still have certain rules.
Yeah.
And then basically the conflict comes when people disagree with those rules. But I'm even thinking of a novel like by Donald Westlake, which is he's a crime writer, an American crime writer, North American crime writer, and he talks about very much like the underworld and the rules that exist in the underworld. And you can see that in a novel like What's the Worst That Can Happen, where a thief tries to steal things from a house, and then the person who lives in the house catches him and then steals something from him. And then after that, the plot of the novel is essentially him and his group of thieves trying to steal back whatever was stolen, because it's against the rules. You're supposed, as a thief, to steal things from people. People are not supposed to steal things from you. And it's a comedy. But that whole set of having rules and like a kind of standard you're supposed to follow is the kind of representation you used to have in a lot of crime dramas. And nowadays, obviously, it's not portrayed like this because it was never like this. People never had like their moral compass. People were always terrible in the world when you have to do things.
Or at the very least, there was pragmatic, because it's like it's always like it's like when they kill a person, it's like, oh, it's not because I enjoy it. It's because it's just business kind of thing. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. But you still end up killing someone. And in this movie, much like in The Mission, there is that kind of idea that you still follow a certain standard and you shouldn't go against that. Nowadays it's kind of made fun of, even in the Reservoir Dogs and like recent movies, you never have that thing. People have switched to more like kind of the funny killers, but it's only come back in the form of John Wick.
Yes,
because John Wick is very much a romantic hero. And I don't think there's much need to talk about too much of the comparison between two, because although it's clear that John Wick takes influence from the killer, the killer is definitely his own beast.
Yes.
Which leads to, I'll maybe briefly to say what I think about maybe what Cho Yun-Fat means to me. Very briefly, but basically I think Cho Yun-Fat is essentially the kind of man I'd like to be when I was a kid. Obviously, I've turned out to be a much different person than Cho Yun-Fat. No one would ever be Cho Yun-Fat. Cho Yun-Fat is Cho Yun-Fat.
Pretty much.
They never try to be Cho Yun-Fat.
I mean, that's a high bar. I mean,
it's a high bar. But really, I think because there's so much sensitivity, and he's not afraid of showing his emotions.
Yeah. Well, I think it comes from the fact that he's just comfortable with his own character. You know, he's not. Yeah, he's just comfortable with it. He's not trying to be masculine, he's not even trying to be emotional. He's just honest. It's just the idea of this is how I am.
He's not afraid to cry. Yeah. He's not afraid to show he cares. And it's something that I think American movies maybe didn't really have that. He's not self-loathing like a John McClane.
Yeah.
He's not like a madman like Lethal Weapon. That kind of his name, but he turns out to be really mad. But he seems like a level-headed person.
Yeah.
Sure, he shoots people and kills people, and sometimes even stabs people
once.
But in the kitchen, like towards the end.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, that was actually cut out one point in some versions.
It's brutal. Yeah. It's Danny Lee at some point. Like, no, it's not Danny Lee. Where it's Danny Lee. Like, looks at him when he stabs the guy, and I was like, oh yeah, that's brutal. Like, he just killed a whole bunch of people. But there is something about stabbing somebody.
It's unusually personal compared to shooting someone. Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. But yeah, regardless of that, he is, as a character, a very emotional person. Mm. And as a person who's kind of very sensitive, like, yeah, it really shows, like, a different side of masculinity that you're used to, particularly in Power Rangers and stuff like that. Like, in that
when
day,
I was 10, like, by the way.
It's big, But, like, that's the version, that's the thing you see. Like, people around you are not necessarily gonna show up and be really, like, just cry or express themselves. Yeah. Like, and then, that character in particular is definitely the kind of like, oh, he's cool because I don't want to kill people.
Yeah.
But I kind of want to be like that kind of person who's not afraid to stand up for his values.
But you can kind of see it in like the, I mean, we don't get spoiled. This isn't really a spoiler because it's in the opening, but when he's given the assignment by his handler, played by Paul Chew, who also does like an amazing job, by the way.
He's fantastic.
But he asks the question about his target. So what did he do? And like Paul Chew was like, what does it matter? You know, kind of thing. Yeah, it's like, it's kind of like, clearly he wants, like, if he wants to take out someone, it has to be for a good reason, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But we're going to come now to talking about the movie itself, because the main thing I think people think about when they talk about The Killer is definitely, and I mean, I got the DVD just next to me. It's showing Fats holding a gun down to somebody.
Yeah.
So he's definitely like portrayed as making people like come down. Like, people are going to be underneath him. He's the tall guy who's going to overcome, and he's very strong. He's got a gun. He's a very strong guy. What I remember from the trailer, if I think back about the trailer, is definitely the gunfire.
Yeah.
And when I look at even like pictures that appeared and that were used then as promos, either in the trailer or when you found on the internet, they're always all about, it's a guy holding a gun and shooting people, and it's highly stylized action. Mm. Really, what this movie is, it's a tragedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's really not, I mean, sure, the action is fantastic, and if you watch it, definitely watch it for the action. But you'll be surprised to find out that the lesson that was taken out of this movie from a lot of action movies, particularly American movies afterwards, where they've tried to emulate the John Woo style.
Yeah, it's the surface level style.
Was a surface level.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so, like, at some point in the church, when they're back to back against each other, that made me think of the cover of a movie that I've never seen. It's called Two Guns, and I think it had Mark
Wahlberg. Yeah, and Denzel Washington. I've seen it. Exactly. Make It Rain.
I don't know if it's any good.
It's actually, you know what? It's actually all right. I actually do enjoy that. It's a good film, I think. You know, I think you would like it as well.
Right.
Yeah.
I might watch it.
I mean, I won't say it's the killer level, but it's definitely,
But it's that kind of like freeze frame of like, oh, those people are badass.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's really not about that. Yeah. Like, people are not being badasses. They are being like, they are romantic characters.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
that's the one of the quotes that you actually had.
Yeah, it was in the John Woo interview, because he does comment on his action scenes and why they're incredibly stylized. And I think it was the question of like the idea of like sort of glorifying or beautifying violence. And in his eyes, it's like, I'm fully aware of my responsibility of, you know, putting artistic works that promotes a good moral sort of compass. But when I make art, I try not to think about audience. I think about what I feel. That's his quote. And for him, it's when he creates these action scenes, he's not necessarily trying to beautify the violence. He's not romanticizing violence. He's actually trying to romanticize the hero. And sometimes romanticizing the hero is actually just getting into the hero's mindset when he's in the midst of action. And in the midst of action, it's, you know, when you're in the midst of action, sometimes it's even the idea of like trying to communicate with your comrades while you're fighting side by side. There's again, this is like there's this idea of like this emotional communication that is kind of like not conventionally masculine in many ways, you know. And just showing like what these characters go through, because essentially they're going through hell. It's like they're going through hell in order to find the light at the end of the tunnel. That's essentially what these action scenes are about, you know, kind of thing. And that's what makes these, not the violence romantic, but it's what makes the hero romantic. But I think when you show it to audiences, it's like, oh, this is very like overstylized and overly romantic. In fact, when the film was released, I believe The Killer, in terms of its initial reception in the West, a lot of people kind of like sniggered at the melodramaticness of these action scenes because they just don't get it. For them, it's kind of, it's so over the top and so melodramatic. To them, it becomes comedy. But then you get the moment where actually, you know, they're sucked into the story, they're sucked into the character, and all of a sudden it's the character that drives the action, and it's not the idea of like we want to like show beautiful violence. It's like, no, we want to show people with, I'm going to say it, generally beautiful souls who are actually in the midst of violent action. It's just violence, just horrendous violence in many ways. So yeah.
Yes, and actually you can see that in the whole way he portrays the communication between the characters, where very often both Danny Lee and Chow Yun-fat will not interact with each other by talking to each other. They actually just look at each other. Either they're holding guns at each other, but most of the time when they only look at each other, they actually say a lot more. So the whole moment where they exchange nicknames and pretend in the flat that they're actually old schoolmates, they both say a lot more just by looking at each other. And the way the exchange looks and what they're looking at and what they're actually saying means a lot more than what they're actually pronouncing with their mouth. And it's a really, really important part of the communication in this movie. Just like it's highlighted later on when Danny Lee is at the police station and is being asked to give like an idea of like, okay, what does this guy look like? What does he look like? And he's talk about like he has a manly air about him, which is probably something that,
yeah, that's probably what
people picked up as being gay subtext. Yeah. And then he also talks about the eyes full of passion and compassion.
Yeah,
which is also going to be taken as gay subtext.
Yeah.
I think the biggest part of this movie that can be taken as gay subtext is Danny Lee being obsessed with Ajong.
Yeah.
At least in a romantic way, is the part when they have all the portraits and he's put like tons of portraits of Ajong like in front of him in the police station. And he's looking at them intensely and you're like, did you just put up posters of your favorite movie star? And you're like,
I would, really. But here's the thing.
But there is nothing after that that makes it they're romantically.
Not at all. And I think, you know, one could argue the idea of a cop obsessively trying to like catch a specific criminal, that's been in other like, you know, films as well. The idea of obsessiveness has actually existed in other films, including American films, I might add. But they just done it, you know, so, you know, and for them to,
it's just like usually it's between somebody who hates
someone, and I think,
and
like,
in that case, he's not.
Yeah, and he doesn't hate him.
He's actually obsessed with him because he's like, but I can see that not necessarily alike.
But
we have something together.
But here's the thing. I think that's what it is. It's like I think for me, it's like it's not necessarily love and compassion, but it's about like trying to find someone who gets him. Because if you think about if you like Danny Lee's character, expectedly, he's like, he's just a cop trying to do his job, but he's actually sort of chained down by like the politics of like of the police force that he's actually working with, you know, that.
But he's an old-fashioned
cop. Yeah, yeah, he's very
much like Ajong is an old-fashioned
exactly
killer.
Yeah, and it's like, I think like Ajong actually mentioned this, is that, you know, that the Gong War, you know, if this isn't our Gong War anymore, as in like the Jiang War, that this is, as in, again, this highlights the whole, you know, is this is kind of like a Wuxia but set in like modern day times, and that,
yeah,
this isn't, you know, I think the only way you can translate that in westernized is that, you know, this we can't, I think what was the quote in one of the scenes is that, we can't, Ajong actually says, we can't, you know, be ourselves, right now in this community or in this society, because we value because we value the past far too much, you know. And
okay, when you say it like this, it can also be seen as gay subtext, but
yeah,
it kind of not is. But I kind of get it why people would see that. Like, as a bisexual man, I can definitely see that. Yeah. Like the way this plays out, yeah, and how it's shot and the exchange and their interactions, it's like, yeah, sure, like they, you could see that they're kind of obsessed with each other, but they're just not either in love or they don't seem attracted to each other. There's a bit of a proximity to each other's bodies towards the end when they talk in the church, like they have a scene together, yeah, when they're like in the same frame,
yeah,
and they do seem, I mean, close, yeah, to each the other way, but they never seem like attracted to each other.
But then, yeah, that's true. And the thing is about John Woo, because he's very much a successor of Chang Che, who also does these types of films. And
yeah, we mentioned that in earlier episode about how masculinity was portrayed.
Exactly, and he's very much, he plays much on those same themes. But unlike Chang Che, John Woo doesn't mind the fact that his films are actually read
subjects.
It's like, if that's what you get from it, you know, fine, you know, I'm not gonna like take that away from you. I think if that resonates you as a person who comes from a gay background or a homosexual background, then, and if it resonates you in a sort of a positive stance, then
doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah. For me, it's like great, you know. So I think John Woo would say that your opinion would still be valid, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So
I wish it was like that. I wish there was like very more obvious gay subtext to it. I'm like, those guys are hard. Like, you can go for that.
Oh man, it's the slick back heads. It's those eyes. This, you know, of Joe.
It's the charisma. They're both not too bad. But actually, that's also the thing, is that when you look at the way the movie starts, Chow Yun-fat is invincible at the beginning.
No.
Like, he really, like he doesn't get shot, blood.
He gets shot, by a goon, though, at the back, you know. That's, like, that's the, you know.
He's all right after that. He gets, then, those bullets are taken out of his body in a church after that. But he seems fine.
It hurts a lot.
And until he uses his scarf, his white scarf, to cover the Sally's eyes.
Yeah, or Jenny. The character's Jenny, but yeah,
Jenny's eyes. Sorry, like the actress is called Sally, but Jenny's eyes. Until he covers her eyes with his white scarf.
Yeah,
he does. There's not blood on it. It's a white scarf. That thing's gonna get stained. Like, he's killing people all around and then no blood on it. He's like absolutely perfect.
It's a little stained. I'm surprised it's kind of fake.
It's a bloodbath.
Yeah.
It's a bloodbath. Yeah. Like, it's like almost doesn't get anything. Or at least in my head, I really didn't see anything. And on the other hand, you have the cop, Danny Lee.
Yeah.
Who's got a more classic American noir intro.
Yeah.
But he also has a spidey sense, because when he's being asked later on, how do you know how to act? It's like, it's the intuition. And later on during the movie, throughout the movie, I'll say towards the end, they both kind of lose their sensibility and their intuition. They become men again and actually have a conversation at the end when they say, you don't look like a cop.
Yeah.
Whereas at the beginning, the guy he's on the cover with says, you look like a cop. At the end, he's being told, you don't look like a cop. And Danny Lee says to show you fat,
you don't look like a killer. Yeah.
And because I think they've gone off of their movie role at this point, they're more just people.
Yeah.
Although they still have like superhuman capabilities when it comes to killing people.
Yeah.
Weirdly enough, they've come out of the shell that they were in. But at the beginning, I really see those two characters as being like kind of, if not stereotypes, at least they're trapped within the tropes of their profession.
Yeah, and I think that's what it is. That's what puts them in like opposite sides. I mean, we talked about how there's that famous scene where they point their guns to each other, but yet they, with the communication with the eyes, they look at each other as if like, actually, we secretly kind of like dig each other. You know, do you know what I mean? It's like,
exactly,
their bodies, but we're not
attracted to each other.
But
we definitely get that we both, because at this point, I think
it's the eyes that belies their physical actions. That's what it is.
And also at this point, Ha-Jong did save a little girl on the beach.
Yes,
and he did everything to save her.
Yeah,
and it's like, well, you know, if you did all that for this little girl while shooting and murdering tons of people, but maybe behind the murder and killing lots of people, there's a very respectful man, which is kind of the part that's mostly maybe ironic. It's like, yeah, you know, he's killed a lot of people. Like, sure, he saved a little girl.
Well,
like,
okay, so
if you had to describe this person in real life, going like, yeah, he shot 12 person, but he saved a little girl. I'm like, yeah, so he's a psychopath.
He still killed a child. But okay, so I think that's a good example, because Danny Lee, when he sees that, you know, Chang Yun-fat's character, you know, he's trying to save the little girl. He's looking past the hitman exterior, and it just like in when Danny Lee tries to confront Chang Yun-fat as a cop near the end of the film, because you know his friend, is this a spoiler?
No. Well, we don't necessarily need to get that, but it gets to a more tragic side of things.
Well, basically, you know, one of his partner is killed, and he's like, he's blaming Chang Yun-fat, and so he's kind of like, I'm going to arrest you as a cop. But obviously, you know, he has to see. And it's only when, and Chang Yun-fat sees that, okay, you're playing cop, so I'm not going to play this game with you. But once he's put in a position where Danny Lee has to make a decision of, do I actually stand side? Do I try to arrest the Chang Yun-fat, John character, or do I, because later on there's like a bunch of like henchmen coming to actually attempt to like assassinate both of them, or do I stand
where do they always get those
I know
henchmen?
Right,
like,
I know,
like,
right,
so many
jeez. I mean I know people, people need to eat, but Jesus Christ, you know.
Yes, the only time I've seen that addressed is either in the Venture Brothers wonderful show or in I think Iron Man 3 at some point, where Tony Stark like starts like not murdering people, but like defeats everybody, and then there's one last guy at the end who's like, I'm not paid enough. Just leaves, and you're like, finally somebody with some sense.
Yeah.
Like, they're killing all of you, just leave. Yeah. Like, this job's not, like, clock out. Like, what time do you clock out? Like, don't you have other things to do after this shootout? Anyway.
Danny Lee's character, he makes that choice of like, okay, I'm going to relinquish my sort of cop sort of like role and like stand with you and try to fend off these villains. It's like, the idea is like, I know the difference between right and wrong, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
not, that's the
thing. And it's like, and that's when that's a stark contrast to like, I know you are, once you take off away the hitman exterior, I know you're a good person. And I think for John's character, once you relinquish your cop sort of like persona, if you will, it's like, okay, I see that you are a person who has a moral code that aligns with mine, you know, kind of thing.
You're not just to obey rules.
Yeah, exactly.
You're there to actually have follow things that matters to you, which is for Ajong's the old ways of the tribe.
Yes,
which I think they mentioned, and actually the partner for Ajong is
Ho-Chu. I think his partner / handler, because that's because he basically sorts out.
He's the guy who
arranges every.
Does, yeah, sorts the mission.
Yeah, exactly.
But he does mention himself that he is a guy from the old times,
yes,
and they have to respect him. And so I think it's Wong Goi, or at least the character of Wong Goi, who's played by Xin Fu.
Yes.
He's, he does mention it early on.
Yeah.
When you feel like he's been disrespected, he says, like, to Gong Xu, like, look.
If it wasn't for you.
If it wasn't for the fact. Well, if it wasn't for the fact that you're all trial.
Yeah.
Like, that you're part of the all trials. Yeah. I will respect you. We will be having this conversation.
It's a weird.
So there's a bit of respect, but like it's more.
It's
of
more
like
obligation.
It's tradition.
It's obligation because it's basically that Chinese tradition of. I guess there's an element of filial piety there that is actually very sort of Chinese tradition. Is that you should respect your elders no matter what, and I think, but sometimes you know the younger generation, it's kind of like. Particularly Xin Fu Hong's character, he's like, oh, I'm not going to be shackled by this old geezer, even though I'm only keeping you around because I'm just upholding this specific Chinese tradition. But if it was up to me, I would like to relinquish it, you know, kind of thing.
But at the same time, when it comes to handling killers, so the new guy that comes in, whereas Ajong has to be paid after the job.
Yeah.
So there's a level of trust of it, like, I'm doing this, but I know you will pay me after, which is the whole deal. After that, he tries to get the money, but he doesn't get paid because he wants to pay for the surgery.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the new guy that comes in has to be paid up front.
Yeah.
He will ask you for more money later on, but at the beginning, he's like, no, you have, and
it's
then
a,
I won't
defend it's very,
you.
It's, yeah,
you.
It's a very pragmatic way of actually approaching things and
exactly.
Compared to the more sort of like, you know, trying to uphold certain like traditions and connections. But
and the funny thing is that actually the boss leader, so Wong Hoi, is shocked. Like, he acts as like, oh god, like, you're asking me for that much money and more money later on.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, but that's what you get. Yeah. Like, you're asking for somebody who's not really bound to duty or respectability or honor. You're asking for somebody who comes in and does the job, and that's it.
I wonder.
Of course, he's gonna ask
funny,
for money.
But, you know, I always found that character to be a very strange character, the new hired gun. You know, because he's never like.
Mm.
He's never focused on that much, if you think about it. He comes across as someone who's like, oh, is he going to be the big... He comes across as like the final boss, but he never gets his final boss moment.
No,
do you know what I mean?
Absolutely not. Yeah, he's just a symbol of the new time. He's a younger guy.
Yeah.
He's got already the sunglasses on. He never takes
them
off. I
know, right? Like, it's like he's just, you know, he's just clearly trying to be like, oh, I want to be really cool, you know, kind of thing. And that's a very...
Yeah.
If you think about it, that's a very subversive way of actually just introducing... that type of character, you know, it's like you are not, because obviously John Woo's incentive is not trying to like, he's not trying to escalate the violence through like, oh, let's present the bigger, better version, you know, it's a very conventional, you know, sort of like almost boring type of storytelling. He's actually, it's like, oh, let's bring in this character who's meant to be like the new version of a Jong, but much more cold and calculated. But actually, it's like...
Yeah, like a robot, like a Terminator 2 type
of exactly, but it's like, the way he gets killed off, like, at the end of it, it's like, oh, it's almost like he's like a nothing character. It's a nothing character. And I think that's John Woo being like, no, it's like... It's like being the bad guy doesn't make you like a much more effective killer. If anything, it makes you even less effective killer. And that's why you get taken out really, really fucking quickly. We're trying to like put forward that you should hold on to your moral code. You should hold on to your...
Yeah, that makes you a stronger man.
Yeah, you should hold on to your character. You know, you should hold on to your like... you should be able to express your emotions openly and not be this cool calculated individual, you know, that the society tells you. So
correct me if I'm wrong, but the killer is attached to the heroic blotches
yes,
which I think at the time when it came out, I think the first one that we label with that genre is A Better Tomorrow.
Yes,
the first one, and it was accused at the time of portraying the triad in a kind of possessive positive manner.
Yeah. So this, again, I think this is just basically a lot of it. I think it's a misreading of like the audience. I mean, you know how it is when they try to like show like a film and it's like and people like judge the film and it's like, sometimes it's like, you have not seen the film, have you? But I think I could kind of see why that may be the case, because when A Better Tomorrow came out, Chiang Effect became
the star. There's the good triad and the bad triad.
There's a good triad and a bad triad, but it's not necessarily glorifying like gangsters, but it's very much trying to like glorify, it's trying to show characters trying to uphold a moral code in a society that doesn't really aligns with their moral code, and what if that's how you create conflict in storytelling. But the issue with that is that you're gonna depict characters who are actually gangsters but trying to like be good people. And I think with the Chiang Effect, I think A Better Tomorrow is actually a much it's a much more, let's say, impactful example. I don't know if I should, I don't know if that's a way.
No, yeah, see, yeah. Because, also because they're really delved like more into the world.
Yeah, trials. And also
one kind of brushes it.
Yeah,
almost.
But the thing about A Better Tomorrow was that when that came out, a lot of audiences, when they saw that film, they immediately tried to imitate the Chiang Effect like style, like the glasses, the long coat, and all that stuff. Even Quentin Tarantino had a hand in that when he first saw that film.
You don't say. Yeah, right. Like, it's all style is ripped off. Yeah. I hate Tarantino, it's true.
But, yeah, so when obviously when that happened, it's like, oh my god, people are trying to be Mark Gore in A Better Tomorrow. They're trying to be part of the triads kind of thing. But for me, it's like, I think that's a miss. That's just the audience misreading the film. And I can kind of see...
If anybody joined the triad after watching The Killer, they missed the point. Because the people from the old triad are getting killed. Yeah. The one with the honor are being killed.
Yeah.
They definitely didn't fit in the new triad.
Yeah.
Therefore, don't go in the triad now. You're going to get killed if you go with those values. That's
In Better Tomorrow, if you look at that film... Diet Long's character, he's actually trying to leave the fucking triad and trying to be a good person. And at the, it's like he doesn't. And Chiang Effect's character is very much, the Mark Gore character is very much like being humiliated by his own triad society. So he obviously has this like, oh, fuck this society, I'm gonna go off and like and do my own thing kind of thing. So that film's like not really glorifying gangsters, but because of that imagery of that specific imagery of Chiang Effect with sunglasses and a long jacket with, it's just so, I mean, it's a very fucking cool image. Of course everyone's going to imitate it, but other people looking at it from an outsider's point of view will actually say, oh, you just want to be Chiang Effect, which automatically makes you, you automatically want to be a gangster. But it's like, you clearly haven't seen the film and got the narrative and got the point of the actual narrative. And
the funny thing also is the way Chiang Effect is portrayed in like the different scenes, that also they're selling back some of the American portrayal. Like the whole thing with having the gun and always having a bullet, one last bullet, is once again a Dirty Harry.
Yeah.
And I would even say that at some point when Chiang Effect, when Ha Jong wears a moustache, he kind of is trying to look like Charles Bronson.
Oh, I never. You know what?
When he showed up with the moustache, I was like, "What the hell is that? He's got a moustache!" Like, you could use so many other disguises.
Else. In my head, it's like, it's not really much of a disguise because you can't hide that charming face.
This guy's too charming and too dashing. The moustache makes it even worse, actually. It's like, oh my god, is it even dashier person? Oh my god, I knew it. But it's like, it really, that iconic moustache really makes him look like a Charles Bronson. Plus, he's got, like, he's using a rifle, just like in iconic movie that Charles Bronson is in.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, I would say there's a bit of that.
John Woo was inspired by some American films, particularly Scorsese. In fact, the shootout after Bo Chu, the handler, betrays Chow Yun Fat, Anjong's the Anjong character. The gunfight that follows is actually inspired by the final shootout in Taxi Driver.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I wouldn't be surprised, to be honest with you, if, you know, if there was a bit of, like, a Death Wish. Is it Death Wish?
There's Death Wish, I was looking for it, I've never seen Death Wish.
I've actually never seen it as well, and all it's, you know, because there's a lot of sequels to that film, and that's, like, I mean, and...
It seems more dirtier and just grim, and I'm like, it's not my stuff.
Yeah.
Like, again, it lacks... What I love in The Killer is the heart.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not when I look at Charles Bronson, I'm like, nah, he's just too much of an old-timey macho guy.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm not into that. Yeah. Like,
no, same
I here. I want my, because even if, again, shooting fat, like in this movie, sometimes he really looks like a superhero. Like, he's so just impossible to kill. It's not the first movie to use that. I'm pretty sure A Better Tomorrow already used it, but a full clip per person is, like, the standard in this movie. I think they even joke a bit about the fact that it's, like, he's never reloading. Like, there's times where I think he loads, but he never really reloads. He always just discards the guns and then just uses another gun.
I'm just thinking. Is there any time he actually reloads?
I think they kind of hint at some point because they there's that whole thing about I always have one bullet left. But it's like, do you really, like, it's more of a mind game rather than anything. Like, he never really, he doesn't really know. How could he count the number of bullets he's firing? He's firing, like, almost, like, I mean, 10 bullets per person. Plus, they all use two guns. Like, and it's not even just shooting fire with us that there's so many people.
I know, right? Everywhere
in this movie. They all jump. They all do, like, that whole church scene at the end is incredible.
Yeah.
For that. Like, we... are talking only about Shogun Fat and Danny Lee in this movie, but all of the people that are being killed in that church scene, there's so many just beautiful stunt work. It's great. Everybody is discarded. Even the guys, when the big villain shows up, they open both the doors. And then
there's this wonderful sort of tracking shot outwards, and you see, and he just, like, shoots the gun, and then he's in the center, and, like, all the, like, the henchmen sort of,
the,
like, it's very dance-like, like Swan Lake type.
Exactly.
Movement, you know?
But that's what I was going to say. Yeah. Like, you have all the doves all around, but even him comes out, when he comes out with all the henchmen around, it's almost like he's got wings around.
Yeah, exactly. Swan Lake. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's a ballet.
Yeah.
It's forget the guns. Mm. Like, the guns are here, but it's, you're just watching ballet.
This just, like, that's, it's just exactly the, what you're watching. The gunfight has, like, a sort of a three-dimensionality about its action, because there is so much more than just standing there and just holding and pointing, like, a firearm, you know? And I think that's essentially John Woo incorporating fight choreography or traditional martial arts fight choreography into gunfights, and that was, like, a big deal back then. Even, like, back, it's and then I think
it's so beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, think about it. I think the action scenes were actually choreographed by Ching Siu Tong. Let me just, you know what? I think it is actually. Second guessing myself. I believe it's Ching Siu Tong. Let me just double check that, please. Oh, okay, I'm gonna go out of the limb and say it's Ching Siu Tong, because Ching Siu Tong is actually known for, like, doing, like, the more wire stuff, the more
which there is some.
But they're not, like, flying wire stuff. It's more like, you know, wire pulls, and to actually just get and more, like, falls and. It's to accentuate falls, essentially, as opposed to, like, make them fly, actually. So
yeah, but they do have kind of superpowers element with the guns counting and always having something around you, like,
I don't know,
it's not like they have superhuman powers. Not superhero, sorry. I should have used superhuman, or at least inhuman in the sense that it goes beyond, like, they're almost gods. Like, partly showing fact, like, he shows up and he's the god of death.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and then through love, because that's essentially, we haven't talked too much about this, but it's essentially a love triangle.
Yes.
And they are trying to protect this woman.
Yes.
Who is a incredible singer.
Yeah.
The song, the iconic song, is still beautiful.
Yeah.
And you could tell, you could almost say that the lyrics from the song are about the two men. And that they're basically just, she's basically commentating on those two men who have a hard time understanding each other.
But
she's almost non-existent.
Absolutely. God.
She is there, like, she's definitely there because they care about her.
Yeah.
But as a person, it'd be hard to describe her in any other way than just being
helpless. I can't really defend her character. I'm having a hard time. I still love the film. I have a soft spot for the Jenny character, you know, and the
she's you feel for her, but is she, like, at the beginning when Ajong saves a child, she has as much personality as the child who's being saved randomly on the beach, because you don't really know anything. She even looks like the little, like, she's singing in the bar at the beginning, and then when she loses her eyesight, she's like again singing in another bar, but she starts to look like the little magic.
Yeah, but I think in terms of
like she's like collecting money, people are like attacking her, and then she needs protection. I'm like,
that she takes an active role is where, because you say it's a love triangle, but she actually chooses a Jong over Inspector Liv when she points that gun. And, you know, it's like I like the fact that she didn't mean to, open fire. And, you know, but at the end, because she still cares about him, but it's like.
But she still cares about him.
Yeah,
for sure.
But it's not like love. And, you know, the way it kind of like sort of breaks Danny Lee's heart, but you know, that's the only time we see the Jenny's character, you know, taking an active role. I will say this:
she makes a decision.
I will say this though: since we're going on the theme of eyes, the fact that she is blind, but I think she's just one of those characters that sees through Chang Yun Fat's sort of Ajong's, you know, killer character, and just sees a good person. And I think that's kind of what drives the Ajong character, is that I now have someone who sees me that beyond this whole, she doesn't see me as a cold-blooded killer.
Yeah.
She sees me as someone who is a good person, even though despite what I did to her, you know, kind of thing. Because at the end of the day, it's like, even though it is an accident, you know, John character did blind Jenny, kind of thing.
And I was thinking also, because while watching the movie, as the movie progressed, she loses her eyesight more and more.
Yeah.
She at first, you can see something maybe a bit blurry. Mm. We see through her eyes. And at the beginning, she sees something blurry, and then towards the end, she doesn't see anything anymore. But when Ajong first appears, it's really hard to think, oh, this woman doesn't recognize the man who shot her. Because you also see a scene where she definitely saw him. Like, she has a clear idea of what he looks like. And then he shows up. And you could argue that she actually recognizes him. And she chooses to ignore him. And choose to ignore the fact that she recognizes and he's the guy who blinded
her. I think that's kind of like, there's something kind of like sort of, there's a tragedy there, because how I saw that scene is that because she actually did say, I will never forget the face of the man who blinded me, and yet, you know, she's telling that to the man who blinded her, but she's not, he's separating that face from, let's say, the voice or the presence of the actual person. And it's like, for her, the face doesn't match with the voice or the presence that she's actually with. And that's what makes it so kind of like, poetic, and when it is revealed that these two are like the same person, it's like, yeah, it does become heartbreaking. But then, you know, she's then given a choice of, okay, I have to like help the cops take you down. She actively makes the choice of saving the Ojong character. Yeah. I think that's where, you know, so it's not, she's not completely a blank slate. She's not completely a motivator for like, I mean, don't get me wrong. She's still not a great, you know, that's a great female character. And I feel like as much as I like Jong-woo,
she's not a very fully fledged woman, basically. Yeah. Like as a person, I have a hard time still.
This is me grasping at straws because I just love this film so much.
But that's the thing. Even though that's the thing. I mean, let's be honest. Like there are flaws in this movie. Like this part in particular. Maybe some of the emotional elements could have been portrayed maybe a bit differently.
Yeah.
But it's still perfect. For what it is, it's still perfect. Yeah. I don't think there's anything, like, you can take away anything from this movie. Mm. Put it in the context of 1989.
Yeah.
It's like John Woo's like third full film.
Yeah.
It's perfect. Yeah. Like, even watching it now, it's really hard to not to find flaws, but to not to appreciate it.
Yeah.
It has aged very well despite everything.
Yeah. Because
everything that was taken away from it wasn't what the movie was about. Mm. People didn't, only John Wick nowadays kind of embodies those elements of tragedy and violence and violence and action and the choreography and the ballet. Only now can you see in an American movie, that's where the killer comes
and
from.
Now, like, and you have an audience that actually accepts that, and that's what I find amazing.
Yeah.
Because think about it, this is 1989, when it was first released, a good portion of the Western audience didn't accept it because it was a bit like, well, what the hell is this, you know? And it's,
what if they accepted the part that they like, that they liked, the part that they wanted to like? It's like, oh, yes, they're really cool shooting people, and then there's all those doves all around. That's a bit funny. It's like, it's not the use of Christianity in the movie is kind of strange, because at the beginning, Ajong says that when he's being assholes, when you come here, he's like, it's just peaceful.
Yeah.
So he doesn't really care. But then every time Christianity comes back and then they're in church, it's for penance.
Yeah.
It's that whole idea of like, I have to be punished for what I've done. So he has to be, he pays, like he could have gone to maybe like a better doctor, like this, like, but no. At the ends, towards the ends, like when they try to, like he has a wound, they use gunpowder.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Like,
I mean, like, I never really understood the size of that. In my head, is that you trying to cauterize the wound? Is that the word I'm looking for?
I think so. Yeah, exactly. It's cauterizing the wound. I'm not sure how that works. Like the using Jack Daniels in other movies seems to be more effective than using gunpowder. So it's definitely more of a penance thing. It's like, oh, I have to suffer because I've done something wrong. Mm. So there's that kind of element.
Yeah,
but
it's
definitely a pick and choose. Like, in a way, you could maybe argue that you can say like, oh, well, Western audiences picked and choose.
Well,
picked and choose when it comes to Christianity. Yeah. It's like, I like the penance idea.
There's something, I guess there is something to do that, because Jong-woo does come from a very strong Christian background. In fact, prior to getting to filmmaking, if he wasn't for filmmaking, he would have become like a pastor or some kind, you know?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
I really thought it was more of a, I always think Christianity has such a Western thing. Kind of see, like, when it comes to Asian movies, that is like, Christianity was around.
Because Hong Kong was colonized by Britain. Yeah, so there's got to be a lot of like, you know, churches and, you know, Christianity around. And I think Jong-woo was very much, that was a place of respite, because he grew up in a sort of a rough neighborhood, from what I understand. And I think that definitely left an impression on him, which you could easily see on particularly in The Killer. And so yeah, but in terms of like the whole idea of pick and choosing, I think for him it's like it's how he interprets a person with a moral code. That's what it is.
Right.
I think that's what it is. And how does that person uphold his moral code? And yeah, and to be honest, yes, with you, the idea of penance, you're not totally off the mark, to be honest with you, because I could see that being a thing, because, you know, at the end of the day, the Chang'e Pak character is trying to redeem himself. I think through every form of like violence, you know, and trying to like save essentially his partner now at that point of the film.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He is going through a multiple versions of baptism of fire, you know, kind of thing. And multiple like tests, if you will. And he's trying to like, is this enough? Am I giving enough? You know, and at the end of the day, you know, you have to, I'm going to leave things pretty vague, but you know, sometimes you have to, even if you give everything, it can actually still, sometimes it's just not enough. And I think that's the ultimate tragedy of this film. And yeah, I think that's what, and I think that really like resonated with me when I first watched it, you know, as a kid, yeah, you know, because it's like, that's a very cutting reality to depict, you know.
Yeah, because it's not a bleak movie. It's a tragic movie. That's the thing. Yeah. It's not, for all of the kind of way it portrays emotion in a very like kind of bombastic way, like it's big explosion, big moments of sadness, it's still very, very humane, and it doesn't like take away all those moments of just pure humanity and sadness and beauty. And I think The Killer still stands as one of the greatest Hong Kong movie ever made.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, I mean, definitely my favorite. So
it's I don't know what's my favorite. I'll have to come back to you on this, but it's up there. I don't know. A Better Tomorrow maybe has. There is something.
You know what? I understand. You know what? I understand why you would say Better Tomorrow could actually be like your number one. I mean, it's definitely many people. I mean, it's definitely it's funny, A Better Tomorrow in many ways is the most iconic Hong Kong film ever made. It's like, it's what, if you want a film that probably best encapsulates what is Hong Kong in many ways, and not necessarily in terms of narrative and character, but what in terms of as a culture piece, A Better Tomorrow is definitely, for many people, definitely is like number one in their list.
It's up there.
Yeah.
So which brings us to the subject of the remake.
Fuck off. Sorry, I know I'm trying not to swear, but
yes. So John Woo in 2023 is remaking The Killer.
Yeah.
Now, although this sounds like an ill-advised idea, it's even less of a good idea when you consider the last movie he made, which is Manhunt. So I think the less
I couldn't finish
it said about Manhunt, you couldn't finish it. I went up until the end and I watched it with my partner, and we were both very confused watching this movie, how bad it was. And at the end, I remember they asked me, who was the director of this? And I said, John Woo. And the look on my partner's face said it all.
Oh, God. It was like, I wish I was there.
What the hell was this? It's very, very bad. It's terrible. There is not one redeeming factor in this
movie. I think a reviewer like really said it best. It's basically a Sci-Fi Channel movie.
Yeah, it's and there's some entertaining ones, but this goes nowhere. It's really, really bad. It's very confusing too. I don't remember anything from the plot. It's just people running around and shooting each other.
You know, and speaking no really depth. Bad English dialogue. So, not like bad, like as in like no one can speak English. As in, everyone can speak English, but there's the dialogue is like really fucking terrible.
Yeah, exactly. Stranglehold has a better plot. and there is no plot reading starting to halt. It's just the Shoyuka character shooting at people in many different ways.
But that's a video game.
It is it's a good video game. It's a very fun
Fun video game, although I have problems with it. Which we will get into
Yeah. But really, like, Manhunt, like, so that brings us to, yeah, the killer. Why is he doing this?
Why is he remaking it?
And it's not even IMDb, actually.
Yeah, well, you know what?
Silent Night?
Oh, God, no, yeah. Silent Night is the film that he just finished. And it's going to be, like, a silent film. It's, like, it's going to be a film with no dialogue. So that film is starring the guy, I've got his name, but he's essentially he's the lead in the first season in I've got the name of the TV show, my might join a blank. He was in one of the Suicide Squad films, or probably both of them.
He was in The Killing. He's also Alex Murphy in RoboCop the remake.
Yes, that's the guy. Yeah. So Silent Night is basically I don't know what's happening, but Jong Woo was actually on Reddit recently, actually promoting that film. He was basically asking audience questions about, well, I guess, anything. But yeah, that film is his latest film, but he is going to be pursuing the killer remake. And that film, the thing is, the remake has been in development for ages now at this point. Like, almost, I would say, a decade? Like, a decade and a half? Because it went through, the co-star, Omar Sy is definitely linked to actually to being one of the stars, but they were trying to find out, Joey was trying to find, like, a lead, and I think he's going for, like, a female lead. Okay. So, I think there was the actress Lupita Nyong'o, who was in Black Panther. She was meant to be cast as a lead, but then something.
Yeah, she's no longer attached to
it. No longer attached to it. And then it's Natalie Emmanuel.
Who
I've only seen her in the Fast and Furious films. She plays Ramsey, the hacker, but.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know her enough. As if you told me, like, Vin Diesel's partner, I can't remember, who was in Dungeons and Dragons.
Yes, Rodriguez, something Rodriguez.
Yeah, she's a really good actress. She's really good in Dungeons and Dragons. I don't know if I would have seen her as the lead in The Killer, but Lupita Nyong'o, I could have definitely seen her as the leading killer.
Exactly.
At this point, it's not that I'm doubting that they could find somebody who's too fit in showing Fat's shoes or Danny Lee's shoes. It's just John Guest, the director.
Yeah,
I don't have a problem with people doing things differently. It's just that can he still do a movie that's going to be good and stand in front of his creation?
And it's it's a weird choice to, I don't know, it's just a weird choice to sort of remake The Killer, because it's not because if you think about it, it's not necessarily the story, it's really the characters and the circumstances. I feel like it's a very specific, when you remake films, you're either remaking it because it has a very good plot, or you know, or it's trying to depict specific characters. Like, I'm gonna use Departed as an example. Like, the plot in that is actually, like, if you remake Infernal Affairs to the Departed, it's almost kind of like, it's quite seamless. But with The Killer, if you look at the plot, it's nothing really special. I would say it's more about what makes that film is its specific texture and how it approaches plot and character. And I don't think that you can actually remake that, in my opinion.
Yeah, because you could also say that it's done in 1989, and like, it's almost like the 90s characters are kind of like the one that you have on the opposite side of Shoyun Fat and Danny Lee. And the way Shoyun Fat and Danny Lee are both introduced is kind of like old-fashioned cinema. So it's also can be seen as a movie as a transition of like, this is how action heroes used to be. This is what action heroes, well, villains in new movies are like, and those two don't fit, and one is gonna disappear, and then the other one is replacing
But then you go,
it kind of also but
if that's the case, then you're kind of like moving that argument forward, because it's like, oh, now we're in 2023 and we're actually depicting the new type of hero that supersedes the previous sort of hero, the previous like generation or the few generations of heroes. And it's kind of like, well, hang on, before you, then you're kind of contradicting, by remaking this, you're actually contradicting the killer and in many ways trying to make it obsolete. Is that what you're going for? I don't think you can do that, really.
I don't know. Yeah, it's, I'm not too fond of this idea, essentially. Maybe the results.
That's the thing. I'm coming from a very, very, very biased sort of perspective, because, like I said, The Killer, number one favorite Hong Kong film ever. So you know, obviously, I'm the.
The way you said ever says it all.
I'm comic book guy in From the Simpsons. That's where I'm, you know. So guys, you know, don't, you know, take.
It's never gonna be as good as the.
Yeah, it's like take my comment with a grain as well, because I will be that. I'll be that shitty Redditor, be like, but Aquaman, you can't marry a woman without gills. You're from two different worlds. You know, I will be that fucking guy. So don't.
But yeah, ultimately, it's not. I think people should just make new movies. It's always kind of what my answer to remakes is. Just make something new. Like, I'm more interested inside it.
Yeah,
like,
you know what? Why not? So am I, actually. I'm actually looking forward to that more than.
And particularly if John Woo doesn't do a piece of shit of a film, like, that's
great. Yeah.
This hate comes from love.
This came from
I can't stand.
It's not hate.
This hate comes from me, like, not looking at this movie thinking, like, how could this guy who made such beautiful movies can do such terrible things?
See, for me, that's kind of like, that's more like, it's not necessarily hate. It's more like, I feel like a disappointed parent.
I mean, it's like you
clearly love your child. I don't know how people who are listening to this, if John was listening, it's like the hubris of this man, but I'm sorry, that's just how I feel.
Absolutely.
I mean?
I'm not even John Woo, and even I am like, what is he going on? Like, but we both want this to be good, so maybe
I hope
it will be
it's
nice
good.
Surprise.
I really do hope it's good, but yeah.
But bottom line, don't wait up on watching The Killer. So I have no idea where you can.
I only have a DVD of it. I don't think it was released in Blu-ray, from my knowledge. I think there's definitely a
there's one.
Oh, there is a Blu-ray.
There is a Blu-ray from a movie on Amazon. Right. But it's
$50. Kind of rubbish, actually, because the only, actually, you know what, you're right, there is a Blu-ray, but it's released by Fortune Star, and they normally just take the SD copy of the standard definition copy of the film and just upscale it onto like Blu-ray, which is not true Blu-ray high def quality, but I don't recommend it,
but you can find it,
okay, so here's the thing, fans are definitely like petitioning for John Woo films to be on Blu-ray, like proper Blu-ray. I believe it, but it hasn't happened for. I believe, from what I understand from reading like forums and reports and reviews and like so on and so forth, I think the issue is that I think it has to do with rights issues. That's why. That's why at this point it's. People are trying. Yeah, it's. I think distributors are having a hard time trying to get the rights of like, even The Killer. You know, I don't know the specifics, but from what I understand, it's rights issues. Basically, the same problem as The Mission. Actually, oh, we haven't seen a good Blu-ray of that because of rights. Because it's all a bit of a mess. Yeah. So yeah.
But. There's
hope. I mean, still holding on to my DVD, let's put it that way. So, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And also, I'm seeing that The Last Hurrah for Chevalry by is available in the Criterion collection. So, I mean, if they are willing to release Last Hurrah for Chevalry, which I don't think it's so. I think
a large reason why they were able to release that is because that I think at that point John Woo was kind of a director for hire. So it was kind of actually made with a specific studio. So he was able to be more expressive with his, you know, with his themes and all that stuff. But he was at that point was a director for hire. So he didn't. So in terms of like who has the most rights of that film, it was definitely the production company. So that's why they were able
to. So
exactly. Yeah. I think it was only until like, let's say, obviously with the Better Tomorrow, it's basically from A Better Tomorrow onwards that the rights issue becomes kind of iffy, you know. So yeah,
so hopefully but you can find it in other ways. Otherwise just try to find it on DVD, because it's worth tracking down.
I mean, I'm still holding on to mine. I'm still like treating it as like the holy grail. It's the one that was released by Hong Kong Legends way back when.
Yes, I believe I have this version. Yes, I have this version in front of me, which has on the menu at the beginning, instead of putting like movie extras or all, they named it Fire to start the movie.
What?
check and a wiretap, which I think wiretap is to check for the language versions. So, I mean, those people make it.
We're gonna make this. Yeah, we're gonna have fun with this. We're gonna show you how, you know, what this film means to us, you know, kind of thing. So
we're gonna have fun with them. Also, it was produced by Tsuya.
Yes, and I think that's where the rights issues comes from.
Oh come on! Also, I got a friend who's writing a book about Tsuya.
No, I love Tsuya. I love Tsuya.
So
don't get me wrong. He's not a bad man. I love Tsuya, but I think there was a point in their working relationship that things got kind of like, I think from what I understand.
I really hope those are.
I love both men. Both of them are so awesome. I have nothing but respect for them. Yeah, I have nothing but respect for them. But I think that's where I'm speculating. That's where most of the rights issues comes from, is because they had like a bit of a riff in terms of like a rough patch in their sort of like working relationship. Again, speculation. So yeah.
Just to clarify, also, I didn't mention I've got a friend who's writing. To brag. I just mentioned it because it's gonna be in French, but look forward to it sometimes in the future.
Like, as in, it's gonna be translated in English.
He's the same guy who wrote. I have no idea. He's the guy who wrote the book about Ringo Lam. So hopefully that's gonna come out.
But hopefully in English, right? I'm being the audience. It's like it's going to be translated in English because I want it. You know, I've become the audience instead of like the co-host here. So it's like, I'm fingers crossed. But yeah, I'm massive. Yeah, exactly. But regardless, massive respect to your friend. You know, for doing that.
Yes, and massive respect to John Woo for making this awesome movie. So do try to track it down, and we'll let you know as soon as we can if it ever gets released again. But otherwise, so you can find us actually on social media. So we're on Twitter, but at some point we'll move away from Twitter because
things are changing.
It also doesn't exist anymore. It's now X, apparently. Elon, what are you doing? So I'm on the Blue Sky. I'm one of the cool kids.
Who's got a Blue Sky guest?
I'll give you an invite. So if you find me on Blue Sky at Hororo, so @hororo.bluesky.social. I'm also on Instagram if you're looking for me. It's @xhorrorox. And I believe you also are on Twitter or X or whatever it's going to be called when we release this episode.
I will also be in Instagram as well eventually, because we've spoken about this. It's like I need to create an Instagram account because it's like basically I just need to be in contact with like a bunch of creatives that Yeah, that's kind of like my incentive.
We like to show up on social media, so look out for him.
I will, most likely by the time we release the next episode, I could give you more details on my Instagram handle. So,
and if it's done, then I'll put the link in the comments. Otherwise, it's not done yet. Anyway, follow us on there. We hope you enjoyed this episode.
Actually, it was a really good episode. I was really happy with it.
It is one of the best. Yeah. So if you liked it, do let us know. If you didn't like it, how dare you?
Please. Yeah. We like to hear all opinions.
Have a great day.
Yes, have a great day or great evening or great whatever. Weekend.
Weekends? What time?
Week. Well, I mean, we're recording this in the weekend, but unless they're listening to this on the week during the week, during their commute, who knows? I don't know. But have a great whatever what you're doing. And
exactly.
And we will see you next time.
Bye.